and we Christian Americans are the last hope for the West. Storytelling matters in this world.
There's a hunger for good stories.
We're tired of seeing Hollywood filth and slop.
That's what our goals are to make movies that are good, true, and beautiful and glorify the Lord.
If we lose, if America loses, that's it for the West. Welcome, everyone, to part two of our movie review of The Fellowship of the Ring. We are diving deep into the world of Tolkien, and we're visiting the world of Tolkien, the world of Middle Earth, in a lot of different ways. One way we're doing it is through looking at the movies, the Peter Jackson films, and really just unpacking them. We tried to do Fellowship of the Ring in one take, but that didn't happen, of course. So we're doing part two. Put in the second disc, and let's roll. Moving on to the second half of the Fellowship of the Ring. We're going to kind of unpack the story really briefly, just as a reminder, a recap, just to get the discussion going. And we have a lot of things to say about this film. And
yeah,
you know, we love these films. Put them aside from the books, and I think that they are masterpieces as far as film goes. It's just incredible that they were able to accomplish what they did. They went to New Zealand and they filmed all these movies. With the extended editions, it's 4 hours each. So we're looking at 12 hours at least of movie, in the span of a few months. I can't remember how long it was, but they went to New Zealand. They filmed it all back to back to back, and it's just an incredible feat to accomplish. And it's great to be able to revisit them, decades now later, 20 plus years. So excited to keep on rolling as we finish up The Fellowship of the Ring. So Tobiah, any thoughts initially before we kind of jump back into the story?
Not entirely. We're going to dive right into where we left off and or maybe recap a little bit, but I'm ready to go.
So the Fellowship is banded together. Everyone is, we've kind of, the stage is set just for taking the ring to Mordor. The mission is clear, and Frodo has decided that he's going to take the ring, he's going to carry it, he's going to bear the burden. And then you have Gandalf, Aragorn, Boromir, Legolas, Gimli, Sam, Merry, Pippin. I don't think I missed anyone. They're all ready to ready to set off and to do this unlikely task, to accomplish an unlikely mission, a mission that is near impossible, but one that they believe will work, as far as destroying the ring and defeating the enemy. And they're going to do it kind of in a small way, in a secretive way. They're not taking an army and marching upon Mordor. We'll get into the eagles eventually. The Fellowship just have the eagles take the ring to Mordor and throw it in Mount Doom? There are a lot of reasons why that specifically could not happen. And I think that meme needs to die. It doesn't make any sense. No. They could not just fly to Mordor. Yeah. There's a reason why they had to take a small group of people and do it under the shadow of all the wars that were going on between Rohan and Gondor going up against Mordor and whatnot. So, anyways, they're setting off, and their first task is to go to the Misty Mountains. There's some debates whether or not they should attempt that, and they go over the Misty Mountains, but then they're forced to go into the mines of Moria, which is where Gimli and his ancestors have dwelled. There's a lot of stories in Moria from the Second Age of Middle Earth. Durin. And his kin, who were supposed to be there, turns out they were attacked by some large beast of some sort and whatnot. But anyways, they make their way into into the mines of Moria, you know, because they get stuck in the mountains, and Saruman finds out through his spies that they're there, and so he attempts through some magic to hinder them from going any further, and so they eventually have to turn around, so they go to the mines of Moria, and then there's of course some conflict. You have the whole scene where they're trying to figure out how to open the door, and you know, trying to read read the elven tongue and figure out what's next, and of course, you know, what he has, finds out that Gandalf finds out that, you know, he just has to speak friend and enter. So enter, or it wasn't Gandalf in the movie. Who was it that
Frodo
figured it out?
Yeah.
My mind is blanking on who figured it out in the book, but anyways, figure out. Elvish word for friend, speak friend, and then enter, and the door's open. Then, of course, they have that octopus beast coming out of the lake to you know, attack them, and they have to fight that off. That was always a fun scene. That's a very memorable scene in the video game. I don't know if you remember doing that, fighting that beast. It was really hard to defeat, and
I do remember that.
That was always fun. Anyways,
yeah.
So they make it into Moria, and they I love how all the Moria scenes are shot. Just you they do such a good job of creating, making it feel like such a large scale, like a very, it's just very ancient, very large, massive fortress underneath the mountain.
Yeah, for sure.
And just the halls of Moria and everything. And I know they use some like miniatures and you know, some visual effects and to accomplish it. But I think I've always been fascinated by Moria. And they don't face much opposition at first. You know, they eventually make it into the halls of Moria, and then they eventually find I think it's Durin's grave. And you have Gimli's scene where he's weeping over, you know, his ancestor,
isn't it Balin, or is it Durin?
Balin might have been there, because I know one of the hobbits from The Hobbit.
One of the dwarves from The Hobbit. Yeah, because I remember Durin even a. Dwarf?
Yeah.
I can't remember which dwarf it is.
He's not in the movies.
Right.
But you're right. The tomb found was Balin.
Balin, yeah.
Okay. My mistake.
That's what I thought. He kept saying his cousin Balin, yeah.
Yeah, cousin Balin. Okay. Yeah. You're right.
Yeah.
Where is Durin? I know Durin has some kind of connection. Durin's
the... Isn't that... I'm thinking of a song.
A song?
Yeah. I think maybe in The Hobbit they sing a song about Durin.
Well, yeah, he's so like he's so, if you watch The Rings of Power, which is awful, don't ever watch it. Durin is a line of dwarves. So there's Durin the first, Durin second, Durin the third, I think.
I think Billy Boyd sang a song at the end of the second Hobbit movie.
Oh,
where he sings about Durin.
Yeah, which is pulled. I think that's what a song that's pulled from the books. But that's, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
I
don't remember that song in the books. No, because didn't he? I thought it was an original song that maybe I could be completely wrong. I don't remember.
But, okay, you might be right. Do we know?
But yeah, Balin, cousin Balin.
Yep. No, thanks for the correction.
Yeah,
Balin's grave. Durin has something to do.
He has to do with the, I mean, obviously, because that's why the song.
So Durin founded the Mines of Moria. He's the founder. That's why I was thinking of Durin in connection with the mines, specifically with Khazad Dûn. He was the founder of Khazad Dûn, but that was, of course, but he's way older than even Gimli is, and Gimli wouldn't have known him. But he's from that line, and so Balin, I'm pretty certain, would be from that line. And so Balin specifically, we know him from The Hobbit. He's the one that died in the mines, and his grave was there where that Gimli found. So Gimli finds this grave, and of course weeps over it, and then you have the sound of the drums, you know. Also, yeah, not only was this the scale and this just the way they captured Kazakh Dune, not only that was that amazing, but I love the sound design and the music and everything throughout this. You know, just a lot of silence was used throughout it. It's not much music, but then you have the drums.
Yeah,
and it has the drums build up, then the orcs come in, and then you hear the orcs as you see them all swarming and making, you know, that goblin noise, their goblin noises.
Yeah, because it's goblins and orcs
screeching.
Yeah.
And they're sitting there, just you hear their screeching, and then they try to take the room, and the fellowship is guarding the door, and you have this whole fight breaks out, and then eventually the troll breaks in. He comes and is like, they have a cave troll.
Yeah.
And then they of course fight it. The cave troll ends up stabbing Frodo. You know, Frodo once again taking another beating. And of course, finds out that he has the Mithril, which Bilbo gave to him. Which we didn't mention Bilbo much. Bilbo gave to him when they were in Rivendell, and of course, it was a surprise to everyone that he had that, and it saved his life because thankfully he was wearing it. And Legolas shoots the troll a couple times in the face and in the mouth, and he drops down and dies. And then it kind of bugged me. It was like all of a sudden all the orcs were gone, or they were all dead at that moment. Like it was just over. Something I missed there.
I think they had killed them all.
They just all died. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. It was once the troll was dead, it was like once you kill the boss, the big boss, the level's over. Okay. Kind of like video game-ish, but
yeah.
But no, it was fine. And maybe if there were any left, they would have fled after they killed the troll and whatnot. But
yeah,
I guess. So they, but there's still an impending threat. And so they flee from there, from the room, and more into the open. They run down the steps, and they confront it. Or then they're being hunted by the Balrog. Mm-hmm. Yeah, once again, you have the sound of the Balrog coming, and the you see through the halls the fire getting closer and closer, and I think it's just great, it's just awesome reveal of the Balrog. This ancient demon beast, and of course there's a lot more about the Balrogs in the Silmarillion if you ever want to read more about them. Gandalf faces off against him, and you have his great sacrifice. And, you know, he chooses to fight to fend off the Balrog to save the Fellowship. Mm-hmm. And of course, when the bridge collapses and the Balrog falls, he of course uses his whip to grab him, and Gandalf has to fall down with him, and then he fights him into the depths. And we don't know at that point what happens, You have his sacrifice, fending off, fighting for his people. In our episode of Middle Earth and Film, we talked about with the characters of who have wisdom. What does it mean to be a wise character? Mm-hmm. Again, Gandalf really exemplifies that, and he is the mentor character that dies. Before and kind of, either halfway through the film, closer to the third act, sometimes earlier on in the film. But there's always that mentor character, or really in the middle of the second act, that will die, and that of course propels our heroes forward so that they can learn the lessons that the wise mentor character has bestowed and given to them, and they kind of live on, of course, through memory and through. Through the lessons that they taught, and they take heed of his final warning to run you fools, and they get out, and you have of course the incredible score throughout that scene when they're all weeping because they've lost the first member of the Fellowship, Gandalf and the eldest of the Fellowship, the one that's been kind of leading them and telling them kind of where to go and what to do, and now he's gone just like that, and they all have most of them were really close to him and whatnot, so it had a huge impact on them. Mm-hmm. But lo and behold, they, you know, that, you know, the threat was, there were still threats impending. You had the spies of Isengard flying over around that time, and so they, you know, hide from them. I'm pretty sure that was that scene, unless that was earlier.
No, I think that was earlier.
I think you're right.
Yeah. That was way earlier, actually.
Okay. Yeah, because that was before they got to Moria.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So anyways, they get out of Moria, and then we make our way to Lothlorien, where they meet Galadriel and kind of learn more about their purpose and their mission, and kind of they're sharing with her what's going on and whatnot, and they, from then, eventually, you know, they leave. You know, you have her bestowing gifts upon them, and she really plays a pivotal role for Frodo, as he's she kind of helps him understand the weight of the task that's ahead of him. And, you know, and it's a kind of it was a time for them to really to tend to their wounds, to really recover before they continue on in their journey from there. Mm-hmm. And of course, yes, like I said, she offers gifts to them and reminds them of the trials that they're facing as they continue. And from then they continue down the Anduin River, which is a great river in Middle Earth. And tension, of course, is growing as they're making their way down. They know that they're being hunted. You have, of course, the scene of the great statues of the Numenoreans, and that which is significant for Boromir and Aragorn.
Yeah.
As they're before the Uruk-hai show up, you have Boromir, who is, he's still struggling with what's his purpose and what's he doing. What are we, whether or not the ring should be taken to Gondor, and he still feels like he needs to be taken. So of course you have him going with Frodo alone, where they have their argument and their fight, and Boromir's kind of the tension grows there until Boromir decides to try and take the ring from Frodo, because he wants that power. He needs that power to save his people. And so he's going to do everything he can, even if now is time. Like, it doesn't make sense to him why they're going to destroy it still. Mm-hmm. So he tries to take it from Frodo. Frodo puts the ring on and escapes. And Boromir, you know, of course, weeps over what he has done. He realizes what he has done. Mm-hmm. And then this is where Frodo is trying to decide whether or not he's, what's he going to do? Like, is he going to stick with the Fellowship? Everything kind of seems to be unraveling, and the growing tension of the Uruk-hai coming upon them kind of pushes him in that direction as far as not knowing what to do. And so eventually they show up, and we have this, you know, great fight between, you know, the Fellowship and the Uruk-hai. And Aragorn, you have that scene where Aragorn meets with Frodo and basically tells him, like, Frodo, it's like, I understand what you need to do.
Yeah.
You need to leave.
And Aragorn passed the test that Boromir didn't.
Yes, that's a good part. That's a good, great scene.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Aragorn passes the test and doesn't try to take the ring. Tells Frodo, it's like, you know, you do what you need to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then you hear Boromir's horn call and the Gondor call, and then the fight begins. And it's just great.
I love that scenes. That whole scene. Like this fight it's such a small scale fight compared to a lot of the other fights in this trilogy, but it's just it's really well shot, and it's cool to see. But also just the scale of this fight is very high for the characters. Like, this is like a very pivotal little fight for them. It's a really cool fight.
Absolutely. And and then, I mean, just jumping ahead, Boromir is, you know, he recovers from his, you know, his fall, and then is having to, you know, fight off the Uruk-hai, and then eventually fights to protect Merry and Pippin. He sees Merry and Pippin are in danger, And Merry Pippin are, you know, being brave and fighting, but they know that Boromir knows that he needs to protect them, and so he's fighting off the Uruk-hai. Mm-hmm. And then this one grand Uruk-hai comes and shoots him with an arrow from mm-hmm. a distance. He gets struck with an arrow, and you know, once again, sound design is incredible in this. Just how you hear that, you know, the arrow and the breath leaving his body, and you know that moment where he's just like, do I fall or do I keep fighting? And then he grabs a sword, keeps mm-hmm. fighting, slashing down the orcs, the Uruk-hai, and he takes another arrow, keeps fighting. You know, like this shows his warrior spirit and shows that his devotion to others, not just himself. You know, maybe people kind of see him as like a selfish character. It's like he's not. He's a character who loves his people, loves his kin, and loves his country, loves those around him, and fights for them. Mm-hmm. But he's a character that fell. He's also human, mm-hmm. and he fell, but repented and keeps on fighting and takes a third arrow and then that's when he's like basically on his knees,
yeah,
basically done. And then the Uruk-hai comes up and he's about to shoot another arrow. Aragorn steps in and you know fights him off, and mm-hmm. they have their fight. And of course, there's a lot of behind the scenes stuff about this fight. You know, basically,
yeah.
Viggo Morrison literally deflecting a knife getting thrown at him.
Yeah.
anyways, pretty brutal fight. Well shot, and you know, Aragorn wins, defeats them, and then you have the scene between Aragorn and Boromir. Mm-hmm. Very memorable scene. Mm-hmm. There, Boromir repents, you know, but he also despairs at the same time. He's like, you know, like he saw. How easily man can fall. Mm-hmm. Like he's like, if I can fall, man, you know, there's no hope.
Yeah.
But Aragorn, you know, kind of, he holds on to hope and says, mm-hmm. you know, of course he has the line where he says, I don't know what blood runs through my veins, but I will fight. I will defend your honor. I will, and he encourages him saying like, you fought bravely. Mm-hmm. You fought to the end and you did what is right. And then I will fight for our people,
yeah,
for our kin. So awesome moment between them. Well built up throughout the film as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah. So Boromir, he has his fall. Merry Pippin are taken. Mm-hmm. Frodo and Sam. Sam finds Frodo, decides to go with him. Frodo was just going to go on by his own. Mm-hmm. his own. Sam finds him. They go off and begin their journey towards Mordor. You have the mm-hmm. scene where they're coming over the hill, and then they see Mordor in the distance. And
mm-hmm.
Roll credits.
Yeah,
and yeah, this is an awesome film. I just love just walking through it and
definitely.
Talking about it again. But yeah. Any initial thoughts right there about any of that before we kind of get into more technical stuff and look at different elements of the story?
No, I mean, I think it. Even though this is just the first of a trilogy, it concluded well, and while also, you know, setting up the next film. But I mean, I think these movies do well at being able to stand on their own. I mean, you have other movies that don't have any sequels that didn't even set up sequels, but have more that's hanging on, and this movie, even though it's the first of a trilogy, is still, I think, it concluded a lot of their stories well.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, everything's wrapped up mm-hmm. pretty nicely just for its own isolated story.
Yeah,
and I think it's just propels the story forward very well into the next film.
Mm-hmm.
And
you
get to know each character pretty well, and
mm-hmm.
it's very, like, there's a lot of action and whatnot, but it's character driven. Like you have these different characters, different traits, different struggles, different hardships, different personalities, all working together for a common goal. Though you find out different motives and you see their different purposes and reasons for being there and for what they want, you know, what their goals are going forward. And then you have characters that are falling, you know, you have, you know, the fellowship does break, you know, Gandalf dies, Boromir dies, the Merry and Pippin are taken,
mm-hmm.
Frodo and Sam have to leave, and you're kind of left with just, you know, Aragorn, Gimli, and Legolas in the end, mm-hmm. and that you have their decision, yeah. You know, to just as to whether or not they're going to follow Frodo,
mm-hmm.
or are they gonna go rescue Merry and Pippin,
mm-hmm.
and they choose to rescue Merry and Pippin because they're trusting Gandalf in that moment. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of going back to the wisdom mm-hmm. character. Like, Gandalf chose Frodo,
mm-hmm.
you know, in a sense.
Yeah.
I mean, he did choose him to go to carry the ring to Rivendell. You know, Frodo taking his decision to carry the ring to Mordor.
Mm-hmm.
But they're trusting Gandalf, knowing, like, hey, Frodo knows what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think you get that sense more in the books. It's just Frodo he's a lot older in the books. He's a more... he's experienced more, lived more, and you can still get that in the movie, but he's pretty young in the movie. That aside, they're trusting that Frodo's going to do the right thing.
And
he's, you know, it's not going to be easy for him, but also, like, they know that we need to fight, on the other end. Okay. Mm-hmm. We're going to go rescue Merry Pippin. And then, of course, that leads them, you know, finding the Rohirrim, going to, you know, fighting alongside Theoden and Helm's Deep and then so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But they know their duty, know what they need to do in that moment. And they mm-hmm. decide, okay, we're not going to follow Sam or Frodo. They've got it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go do our fight. Let's go save these hobbits that do need our help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah. Different elements, just looking at characters and character traits, heroism is a very, you know, evident theme in the story. Looking at Aragorn, you know, he is a hero character,
mm-hmm.
Who's alongside the rest of the characters to fight for them, to protect them. He comes in to save them, you know, multiple times, you know, going back to when they're at the the Green Dragon, when they're being hunted by the Black Riders, the Nazgul, Aragorn as Strider is kind of watching over them and, you know, making sure they're okay, and he kind of saves mm-hmm. them, but from getting, you know, attacked from the Black Riders and whatnot, yeah. But.
Yeah, he knew what was hunting them.
Yeah,
yeah.
So he's kind of there, looming and watching over them and making sure they're taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
And then, excuse me. And then throughout the story, he's multiple times just kind of being that protective character for our hobbits. For mm-hmm. you know,
yeah.
The scene in the forest towards the end when they're being. They're on the pipe when they're being hunted by the Uruk-hai, you know, Frodo or Aragorn, you know, has that scene with Frodo, and then, you know, I of course I love that scene where he's the orcs and the Uruk-hai are coming towards him, and then, you know, he pulls out his sword and he's fighting them,
yeah,
on his own, just really take them, you know.
Yeah,
and give Frodo a chance to run to get away. Mm-hmm. So great scene there.
Yeah.
But yeah, we have, you know, unlikely heroes doing unlikely things. You know, Frodo is a hero character. You know, mm-hmm. He's going to save the world.
Yeah.
And he's making a decision that many would not be brave enough to make.
Right.
You know? Yeah. He's the only one that stood up and said, I'll take the ring to Mordor.
Yeah.
I'll do it.
Yeah. And yeah, he just had his simple life in Hobbiton, and
mm-hmm.
I mean, it really all just came down to the fact that he was related to Bilbo, and I mean, that was what set him on. Not that that's where, like, not that he didn't have the virtues necessary, but a lot of what was a lot of the responsibilities put onto him were there just simply because they were thrust upon him because he was related to Bilbo and had to
mm-hmm.
take on those responsibilities, and those two things go hand in hand, the the fact that he had the virtues and that they were required of him as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, and Gandalf, mm-hmm. you know, he's kind of a hero. You know, he mm-hmm. fights off the Balrog. You know, no one else does it. You know, it's kind of, you know, it's as far as power levels go, he's definitely closer in power level to something like a Balrog. You know, they're both mm-hmm. ancient beings,
yeah.
basically. And he, you know, he fends him off, he fights him off, and almost defeats him. You know, gets dragged down at the depths, and you know, fights him to the death.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he's a hero that falls, but he falls fighting and mm-hmm. you know, trying to, you know, defeat the villain mm-hmm. and you know, whatnot, and giving yeah. his life for to save his people.
Yeah.
I don't know, kind of, you know, masculine archetypes that we see as well. Aragorn, once again, it's just mm-hmm. I just admire, you know, his leadership, his strength in masculine values. You know, a man who's courageous, the man who's, you know, he's self-mastered. You know, he's not, you know, you have that scene where he doesn't give in to the ring. He doesn't try to take the ring. You know, you have that brief temptation there, but he doesn't give in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just, yeah, that shows, you know, self-mastery. And mm-hmm. he's willing to do the right thing, not for the sake of personal gain or anything, but, you know, for others. And to be the man that he should be, that he is meant to be as the Isildur's heir, mm-hmm. And just as a man, as a soldier, and as a warrior. So, and yeah, anything. And what's your kind of perception of Aragorn overall, just as a masculine archetype?
I mean, I think he carries those virtues strongly. Mm-hmm. I think he, you know, especially with his heroism, his bravery, he's very he's slow to his emotions. He thinks through things. He's not gonna lash out or anything like that. He's very well thought out, and he's mastered a lot of what it means to be a man, and controls his emotions well, and is brave and willing to do what he is called to do. And yeah, I mean, he's got the strength and the leadership and all that good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, and going back to that scene with him and Frodo, you know, he has one of my favorite lines in the trilogy. He's like, I would have gone to you with the end. I would have gone with you to the end, yeah. into the fires of Mordor.
Yeah. You
know? I would have gone with you to the end, to the fires of Mordor. I would have fought by your side,
yeah.
all the way through. And, you know, once again, going back to, like, he knows that Frodo needs to go on his own. Mm-hmm. But he was willing to go and fight. And he does, mm-hmm. you know, he keeps on fighting and keeps on, you know, leading and doing what he's called to do, to give Frodo his best fighting chance, mm-hmm. the best chance that Frodo can give. Aragorn's giving his everything that he can for yeah. the sake of Frodo.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he contrasts well with Boromir and that, and where they're both, you know, willing to fight, but, you know, Boromir does fall in that moment. Mm-hmm. You know, he's tempted by the ring and he tries to take it and tries to, you know, almost in a sense hurt Frodo, take whatever he needed to do to take it. And but you have his repentance, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I kind of a couple other things, like, I liked the world building throughout in Peter Jackson's novels, or Peter Jackson's films, adapting the novels. It's interesting. It's, I think we talked about this in the first one, maybe. It's hard to really, discern, at least for me and probably for you, the kind of Tolkien's Middle Earth, without thinking about Peter Jackson's because right. we grew up on the films.
Yeah.
And you know, primarily grew up on the films, to my regret. But it's, you know, so I think overall he captures this world well, and he has mm-hmm. his own, he just has his own taste, spin on it, and own flavor, you know, mm-hmm. but it's, he builds the world really well, and adapting the different characters, the different places, and giving them life, giving life to these stories, to these locations on these locations on maps, and, mm-hmm. and really bringing them to life. You know, he of course goes to New Zealand to do it mostly, but and you know, New Zealand is a beautiful, incredible place. But I mean, but mm-hmm. just the castles that he creates, the lands that he creates. Look, talking about Moria, just what they were able to accomplish with Moria is incredible to me.
Yeah,
how they structured it and how they filmed it, and just this they created this under this fortress mm-hmm. underground, this underground city almost.
Yeah,
and did it this old ancient city, and did it so well. So
yeah, just, yeah, I think yeah. he did. Yeah, he did a really good job of creating Middle Earth, creating this idea in your head of like these places, they're real places, and these lands are set apart, and you know, this is Gondor, this is Mordor, just even when they're, you know, in the White City, and I mean I don't think they ever go there in Fellowship, but like when you see that, and then you can see Mordor across the way, and just all that is just really cool to see, and just how he built all that, and yeah, mm-hmm.
yeah, definitely, and yeah, just the landscapes, and you know, of course, I'm trying not to think about Two Towers and Return of the King, but this yeah. continues on those, but they did a really job at using miniatures, mm-hmm. A lot, like I think Rivendell was, they used a lot of miniatures to. Mm-hmm. capture Rivendell and Lothlorien, and the Lothlorien was probably more, a lot of it was in Foamdome Forest and whatnot, but and sets, they made these yeah. massive sets as well,
yeah,
but when they could, they used, you know, real life locations, and
mm-hmm.
which is so cool to see. Actually there was, yeah, before we move on from characters, and one character also, Saruman. I love the villains in Peter Jackson's films, and you know, of course, in Tolkien's, even more in Tolkien's books, but specifically how they're depicted in the films. I think it's a good contrast between good and evil. You have Saruman, who's a good contrast with Gandalf. Mm-hmm. You know, you see a wizard, you know, two wizards, two Istari, you know, ancient angels basically that fell into Middle Earth. They're, you know, these ancient beings, and you have them contrasted very well, where you have Gandalf, who's, he's trying to learn about what's going on with this ring. He's seeking out knowledge, and you know, he's going to the halls of Gondor to learn and whatnot. And he's trying to discern like what is happening here in Middle Earth. There's something going mm-hmm. on. And then you have Saruman, who also is interested in wanting to learn. You have you incorporate the Palantir more in the second one. We'll talk about that when we get to it. But Saruman's, he's also wanting to learn and understand, but you see that he's slowly being corrupted by his lust for power, and by mm-hmm. specifically by Sauron, and he's growing influence and growing power in Middle Earth, and he loves that, and he wants that, and he's trying to extend his influence and bend creation to his will. You get mm-hmm. that more in Two Towers, of course, with the Ents and what he's doing to the forest, but even with the orcs, like he's breeding these orcs, mm-hmm. these evil malicious creatures who also, like, you know, think of, go back to Rings of Power, you know, where they try to make them seem like misunderstood villain, you know, bad guys. It's like, no, these are malicious evil creatures that mm-hmm. that are bloodthirsty, and they're just evil.
Yeah,
which. It's fine. It's good, you know, and you know, we don't need them to be misunderstood and have, like, you know, daddy issues and whatever. You know, yeah. Like, no, no, they're evil beings. They are bred for war.
Yeah,
and that's what they are. And so you have Saruman, and you know, his orcs, and the Uruk-hai that he breeds, you know, out of Middle Earth, or out of Isengard, mm-hmm. and. But anyways, you see the contrast well between him and Gandalf, which I appreciated.
Yeah.
And And then, you know, the orcs, and these are evil creatures.
Yeah.
You know? Saruman and
I think,
evil.
And I think with him versus Gandalf, you really see that Saruman does not care about the creatures of Middle-earth at all. Mm-hmm. And Gandalf, you can see that he loves the creatures of Middle-earth, and he's very fond of them, and even he has a certain admiration for them, and Saruman, you can see that he doesn't at all. He sees them as beneath him, mm-hmm. as very lowly creatures that do not deserve any sort of amount of his attention other than to be used. And yes, I think there's a pretty clear contrast there as well.
Right. Absolutely. yeah, that's well set up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you know, Sam as well, just a loyal friend to Frodo, and just his willingness to go to the fires of Mount Doom for Frodo. And
yeah,
he's always by his side. He decides to follow him, you know, to Rivendell, follow him to Mordor in the end. He's like, you know, he almost drowns in the river, you know, trying to get to Frodo. But you just see his devotion. It's like, I'm going with you no matter what. You know, I'm not letting you go by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I have to die, I'm going to fight. I'm going to get there unless I die. You know?
Yeah.
But anyways.
Absolutely.
It's good. And, yeah. Any other characters you want to highlight, bring up?
No, I mean, I think, I think there's just a lot of expansion in the second movie with some of these characters that not a lot happened to in the first. But yeah, I think all the main ones of this one, I think we've covered pretty well. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, Aragorn, I did actually write this line down, but when he's, you know, with Boromir before mm-hmm. Boromir dies, and he says, I don't know what strength is in my blood, but I swear to you, I will not let the White City fall.
Mm-hmm.
Referring to Gondor, it's like, I will not let our people die. I will not let our land fall to Mordor.
Mm-hmm.
So he just has that promise that he gives to Boromir. I think there's a great character moment for Aragorn.
Mm-hmm.
But which also kind of leads me into another discussion that I wanted to give, and that's kind of some of the differences between the books and the films, because in that line, though I love that line, the problem is in the book Aragorn, he does know what mm-hmm. blood is in his vein. Like, you know, he's always struggling in the films with whether or not he's a reluctant hero, though he knows his duty and he does his duty. Mm-hmm. He is a hero, but he's reluctant king, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's which is more of a kind of a Hollywood thing, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, you just kind of have to have that. You have to give him that character arc mm-hmm. that isn't really present in the books, because in the books he gets Narsil, he gets his sword and Durin pretty early.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he gets it in the Fellowship. He doesn't get it in mm-hmm. Return of the King. So he or I said Anduril. Mm-hmm. I always get those mixed up. He gets Anduril pretty early on in the story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he has the sword that was broken. It's now been forged.
Yeah.
He is waiting for his time to take the throne. In the movies, mm-hmm. He's like, I don't know if I'm ready. You know, kind of thing. Yeah. You know, yeah. That's always bothered me. Though I get it as far as from a story standpoint, mm-hmm. character arc, but I don't think it was necessary.
Right.
In my opinion. Yeah. But either way, you know, he does know that he's the Sildor's heir. He does know that he is the future king of Gondor.
Yeah.
He does know that. But he's a patient. I think that's the difference. He's not reluctant. He's a patient king.
Mm-hmm.
He knows his time. You know, like Christ. You know, he doesn't. Jesus doesn't take the throne. Doesn't take the David's throne by force. He doesn't come and just be like, "Oh, it's my throne. Give it to me. I'm gonna sit upon it right now." Like, no, he knows. he knows when his time is. Mm-hmm. He's patient in waiting. And of course he knows he has to go through death in order to get there. And you know, Aragorn, he knows what is ahead for him. He knows the throne that is his, and he's waiting and he's ready to take it when mm-hmm. when it's his time. But yeah. He's waiting for his time. So
yeah. And I feel like that anticipation could have been portrayed in movies pretty well. Mm-hmm. I would agree. It wasn't entirely necessary. I mean, I think you can definitely build anticipation and confidence in him in that, and but show that it's not like an overpowering thing of him that is a flaw,
mm-hmm.
but that he is patiently.
Yeah. And like another character I've always had an issue with is Elrond in the movies, because even his relationship with Aragorn, like because he's Arwen's father, they kind of had to make this like, you know, like you're not good enough for my daughter kind of thing. It's like,
yeah,
no, I'm sorry, I don't really like that. Yeah. He's like, he distrusts Aragorn, mm-hmm. and you just don't get that sense in the books. As far as I'm aware, he kind of has that distrust for Aragorn, and he doesn't think he's ready for the throne and so forth. And he's not ready, not worthy of his daughter. You know, of course you have the forbidden love, that is more drawn out in the films. Either way, I think he's a little bit, I don't know. He always rubbed me the wrong way, Elrond in the movies, but
yeah,
there's that.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Because Aragorn also says, I don't want that power. And it's mm-hmm. kind of like that, like power is bad kind of thing. You know, and they're trying to contrast it with Boromir a little too much in the movies. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, no, Aragorn does want that power. He mm-hmm. does want to be king, but he wants it in the right time.
Yeah.
When it's his turn.
Yeah.
So, yeah. One second. Yeah. And also, there was another difference in the movies. I misspoke last time when I said that Arwen in the books saved Frodo from the Nazgul in the river after Frodo got stabbed. That wasn't true. That's not true. That happened in the movie, but in the books, it was Glorfindel, who's an elf that is completely removed from the books. He might have like appeared once in the movies. But Glorfindel, he's actually, a male elf is the one who actually goes and saves Frodo after he gets stabbed and takes him to Rivendell. Arwen's not really there. They do that so they can.
I think that's what you had said last time.
Maybe I did.
I think. Well, no, you didn't mention him, but Glorfindel. I think you said that it wasn't Arwen.
Oh, okay. I thought I misspoke, but maybe.
Yeah.
Because in my head, either way, sure. Glorfindel, character that was kind of removed from the books, and they used Arwen. I don't know if it was just to give her that. I mean, it gives her like a nurturing role in a sense. You know, she's coming to save mm-hmm. and nurture Frodo. But she's also fighting off the Nazgul and mm-hmm. whatever. I think that it was also just a way to kind of bring Arwen more into the story for Aragorn as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was the setup for their relationship. For the hints at their relationship
right
in the beginning of that movie,
right?
Or beginning of the trilogy, I guess it wasn't, because I don't think it's even the beginning of the movie, but it was definitely a setup for their relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That otherwise would have been way later and
sure
and could have been confusing,
right?
I suppose.
I think so. That's fair. And then Frodo, Elijah Wood. I go back and forth, because growing up in the movies, like I know Frodo as Elijah Wood. That's mm-hmm. when I read the books, that's what I think of. But I have to always remind myself that's not Frodo, because he's a lot older in the books. He's a mm-hmm. lot more mature, a lot more older. He's less whiny and a little bit more put together, I guess, than Elijah Wood is at times. And nothing really against Elijah Wood. I think it's just the role he played, the role he was given. You know, he's they don't give Frodo as much time to age in the book, in the movie, as it does in the book, which is, I kind of understand, you know, because you're making a movie, you don't need like a 30-year time gap for Gandalf to go and read a bunch of books. And it's like, I kind of get it. But I don't know. I think that Frodo could have been played by a more older, more mature actor. It kind of might have been a little better, but might get some flack for that. But anyways, that's kind of, so I kind of always been my issue with him. I don't, in the movies itself, put aside the books, I'm mostly fine with it. Mm-hmm. I'm fine with Frodo. I'm fine with Elijah Wood, with the character that he chose to play and he was directed to play. Mm-hmm. But anyways.
Yeah.
And then Tom Bombadil, I'm not going to really spend much time on him. He probably shouldn't have been in the movies, so it was probably better that they didn't, just because I go back and forth on this one too. Like, I would have loved to see Tom Bombadil, but at the same time, they probably wouldn't have done him justice. And it just, I don't know. I don't think that he would have worked in Peter Jackson's films.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. But Tom Bombadil is one of my favorite characters in Middle Earth. So, so there's that. And then Amazon decided to include him for whatever reason, and it was atrocious. It was absolutely atrocious. One of the worst characters ever put on film. Oh man, talk about not doing it justice. Until this moment, I totally forgot that they did that, and I was like, don't watch Rings of Power once again. anyways, Galadriel, another character, you know, really well done in the films, terrible in the TV show and the Rings of Power.
Oh yeah,
great
yeah.
in the books, but anyways. Moving on, I don't know, is there anything specifically that comes to mind for you as far as books and movie?
No, not really.
Yeah, that's fine. Like I said, we talked about the score. I mean, concerning Hobbits is just so iconic. But I think it really just kind of gives life to Hobbiton in a unique way. I think that was really done, really absolutely. Well done.
Yeah. No, the score is so good because you can play any song and you think of a city. Like, or a portion of
Gondor, of Rohan,
Mordor, the Shire. Like, they all have their songs. And, it's very well done. I mean, it just as Tolkien did amazing with his naming of things and the way he used names, like the music was done just as well in that, like you hear the song, you know, this is evil, you know, this is good, you know, which city this is, you know, like this location. I mean, Isengard has a song, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you could decipher between Mordor and Isengard and their songs, and it's like, and know that they're both evil. Very well done.
And you know, if you read the Silmarillion, you know, music has plays a big role in Lord and Middle Earth. If you read the Silmarillion, you know that music plays a big role in Middle Earth, and I'm not gonna dive into that, but anyways, you know, and of course Tolkien, he was a big fan of music, and you know, and there's a lot of songs that he wrote in poem and slash songs that he wrote throughout his books, and music is important, and I think Howard Shore just does an incredible job of capturing the atmosphere of the world of Middle Earth and giving music to it to give life in that way. So well done. I don't know, cinematography, anything specifically you want to bring up? It's interesting that, like, you know, we've gotten these, you know, we have the 4K versions now of the Lord of the Rings, and, you know, so it kind of gives that extra layer just gives an extra layer of clarity to the films. And
one thing that's interesting with these movies that are coming out on 4K that were originally filmed during the time of DVD.
Yeah.
I noticed it tremendously with these movies, is like you can see the CGI so much more on the 4K.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Interesting.
It's like, oh, like with the DVD, it all just looked kind of blurry together. Now I can see the blurry part. It's the CGI part. And the rest of the shot is very crisp. And it's like, oh, well, like, it's because they, yeah, they would have had to redone the CGI. But other than that, like, I mean, like, that's CGI. But
we need the special edition now.
Yeah. 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 They need to upgrade all the CGI and just redo the whole thing. No, but the cinematography, I mean, I think they did great. Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, they it's really well shot. The coloring of how they colored it, and yeah, I mean, it adds to the world building. Like we really see just this world that he built, and the way he does the cinematography comes out in that as well, and the way it's colored, and the different areas of Middle Earth and how they're colored, and all that is, yeah, I think it was really well done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any thoughts on, I mean, yeah, I mean, you're going to New Zealand and you're capturing this almost like this other world. It's just these beautiful landscapes, and I think they do a good job at showing the scale of Middle Earth. Mm-hmm. You know, you have like the castles, you have Minas Tirith, where Gandalf's coming over. Just the first thought that came to mind, Gandalf is riding his horse coming over the hill, mm-hmm. and in the camera kind of pans, and you see Minas Tirith over on the over the hill, and you know, it's just kind of, you get a sense of the scale of Middle Earth mm-hmm. just from that shot. And I think they just do a good job, and you know, once again, Khazad Dûn in the Mines of Moria, just well shot and mm-hmm. and well lit as well. And, you know, with the coming of the, well, you have the, all, like I said, all the orcs, and they're, you know, crawling around, and then, you know, you have the coming of the Balrog, and just how that was mm-hmm. was lit and shot was incredible.
Yeah, so very much so.
Yeah, it's great stuff. Anyways, yeah, to kind of close things up, you know, I think this movie, just people don't realize how much of an impact this film, these films all had, just culturally. Like, I don't know really anyone. I know some people, I've known some people have not seen them mm-hmm. at all. Just never yeah. watched them. That's not into fantasy or mm-hmm. whatever. But a lot of people, most people have seen these movies yeah. And most people like these movies.
Yeah.
You know, the only people that really don't are like diehard Tolkien purists, which I'm kind of slowly becoming, stop me. but for the most part, people really love these films mm-hmm. And you know, just of course when they came out, the, you know, how massive it was, you know, in theaters, you know, the amount they made, lots of money, you know, everyone wants to see them, and everyone still sees them. And then you had the extended editions, everyone wanting to buy the extended editions, and that's like the only way you can watch it now, you know, basically. And yeah. Now the 4K release, you have Steelbooks, you have all these things, and it's aged so well, mm-hmm. and it's going to continue to. They just came out. They just did the 20th anniversary, 25th anniversary.
Yeah, 20th for maybe Return of the King.
Yeah, it'd be 20th for Return of the King.
Maybe Fellowship.
Yeah, it was 25th for Fellowship, and they re-released all three in theaters. And guess what? It made millions of, like, I mean, I don't know how much. It made a lot of money. You know, not crazy, you know, but it was like, you know, within like the top, you know, five box office for that mm-hmm. for the week, first week it came out. It's like,
yeah,
that's not an easy thing. You know, well, it is nowadays, but people want to go see these movies again. They want to see these old films, and it's just like the cultural impact, but also just how well known these movies are, and how just it's something that everyone likes. Mm-hmm. Everyone loves watching these heroes, mm-hmm. watching these characters. You know, watching this story that Tolkien created, mm-hmm. and you know that he put pen to paper, you know that he wrote for you know many generations, and you know that, you know, generations that are, you know, and more and more generations are now reading these books and loving these books, and then watching these movies and loving these movies. And like, I think I said this in the first one, it's like one thing that was really great about this film is that it led people to the books in an age where movies were, you know, where most people got their entertainment. It pushed a lot of people like myself to read the books.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that about the movies. You know, of course I would encourage anyone that's not seen the movies to read the books first. Please do that. But yeah. I understand, you know, that's just kind of not the world we live in nowadays, and you know, and that's what it is. But yeah, just the impact this has, you know, just everyone loves characters like Aragorn, mm-hmm. Legolas, Gimli, Gandalf, Frodo,
yeah.
Sam. It's just characters are talked so highly of in today's age, and in an age where we don't have characters like this, mm-hmm. we don't in storytelling.
Yeah.
We don't have Aragorns anymore. We don't have heroes like Frodo.
And yeah.
Even you know, devoted characters like Boromir, you mm-hmm. know, who loves his people and is willing to fight and die for his people, mm-hmm. Go yeah. to the ends of the world for them. It's like, we don't get that anymore. And so it's just, they stand the test of time and they will continue to.
Yeah, just absolutely. Awesome. Well, another thing for so Smeagol wasn't actually in this movie really, hardly right. at all. Like, we didn't get to see the full motion capture Smeagol. But talking about, you know, groundbreaking, like Smeagol and the motion capture that they did for him was groundbreaking. Mm. It had never been done as far as I know, to at least to the scale that they did, where they had a motion capture character on set with the other actors capturing his movements and all that for the scenes, that just hadn't been done before. Course we'll I'm sure get into that into the Two Towers, but yeah
and we'll just I'm curious to see how Hunt for Gollum was going to be. Movie's gonna have a lot of Gollum, and I'm just wondering how well they're able to capture that today, and because they did an incredible job, and it'll be interesting to watch it in 4K. Mm-hmm. Two Towers, I've not watched it yet. I've not watched it in 4K ever. Mm-hmm. They'll do that, but just interesting to see how the CGI stands up. But I know it mostly stands up well.
Yeah,
it's what, you know, for the time, for when it came out.
Yeah, for sure.
This movie, one thing I just is kind of finished up. It's for all people. Mm-hmm. Everyone can enjoy this film.
Yeah.
Even though there's not any women in the Fellowship, like, women can enjoy this show, this movie, and watch this.
And many women do.
And many women do.
a lot of women that have never seen it and watched for the first time are usually pleasantly surprised.
Right.
How much they can enjoy it. It's not, these are not war films. There is war in them, but it's not like, you know, a typical war film that you would think of. It's not, you know, Braveheart or Gladiator or something like that, where, you know, it's just ultra masculine movies. There is masculinity in them, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's definitely for everybody.
Yeah. I mean, if you're not a fan of fantasy, this is still a world that I think we all need to escape into sometimes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a world of good guys and bad guys, you know, mm-hmm. you know what's good, you know what's evil, mm-hmm. and a world of characters that inspire you towards truth, goodness, and beauty. A film about, you know, good triumphing over evil, mm-hmm. in the most unexpected way, mm-hmm. Which is the gospel. Good triumphing over evil in a way that you would not expect. The serpent being crushed by the seed of the woman, after being bruised, and him, defeating the serpent and doing it in an unlikely way. And that's the story that we have. And that's the story that's timeless and continues on to today.
Yep.
So Tobias, let's rate this movie. Go back to our old rating system. 1 out of 10, you know, got some decimal points in there.
Yeah.
So it's really kind of 1 out of 100, if we're being honest, but we'll do 1 out of 10. What do you got, Tobias? Yeah. Is this a 10 out of 10 Fellowship of the Ring?
No.
No, it's not. Not perfect.
And this is like, this is my least favorite of the three.
Okay.
Probably
agree.
Yeah, I would give it, it's maybe a 9.5 or a 9.6 for me.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe not. I would say 9.6 is probably where I have it.
Yeah. Yeah, because like I'm thinking Two Towers and Return of the King. Like I think Return of the King is definitely better. But this movie alone, even by itself, I would give it a 9.7.
Mm-hmm.
Just because like I think it is nearly perfect.
Yeah.
As a movie.
Yeah.
It is nearly perfect.
Yeah.
Books aside, adaptation aside, it's not perfect.
Yeah.
But as a movie, like that's 9.7.
Yeah.
So would you want to meet in the middle, 9.6?
No, I think 9.7.
Okay.
9.7 is good.
Two Towers would be 9.8, and then Return of the King will probably be 9.9.
Yeah.
Just being honest.
Okay.
I don't know. It's been
yet.
A while.
Yeah.
I know. We'll review them and we'll get there.
Yeah, that's probably right.
9.7.
Yeah, but 9.5 is too low, and then 9.6 is, I would say 9.7 is good. Yeah.
Because we're being honest, like looking at the landscape of films, like join our Patreon. We are attempting to review pretty much every movie ever.
Yeah,
we're gonna Cigars and Cinema. Go check us out.
Yeah.
Our Patreon show, but
talk through at least five movies.
Like these three movies are just they're some of the best movies ever made, if not the best. It's they just are.
I don't
care what anyone else says.
Yeah.
So, anyways,
for sure.
That's it. Thank you guys for watching this part two, finishing up Fellowship of the Ring.
Yep.
Stay tuned for the Two Towers. We'll dive into that one, and there'll also be two parts. And looking forward to that one. And so, thank you guys. Encourage you to watch good movies and glorify the Lord in all that you do. Enjoy good stories. Pick out the bad, the ugly, but also honor the glorify the good and then live your stories. Live stories that are good, beautiful, and true. And let other stories inspire you towards that goodness, truth, and beauty.
So, yeah.
Thank you all. We're out.
Thank you. Bye.
Okay, just hit the red button.